Hello, nursing community. Welcome back to another episode of Two Male Nurses. And today we're going to discuss...
Oh, yes, my good man. Just a couple of British chaps here. We are going to discuss the age-old question. Too prone or not too prone? That is the question.
Let's prone him.
Let's prone him.
All right, nursing community, I hope you guys enjoyed our little impersonations of those accents. We had a fun time doing that. Today, we're going to be discussing proning and paralyzing. We're not going to get too deep into all the nitty-gritties of ARDS. That's going to be its own individual episode. But we really wanted to bring this, something that we've seen a lot recently with COVID-19, and we really wanted to talk about it. We felt like there was a lack of understanding from ourselves and from our fellow colleagues that, hey, this is why we're proning and why our PaO2 is 300 now.
Nice. Right? Yeah. And you'll hear the doctor, our intensivist will just come in and just toss it out there like, hey, boss, what's the PF ratio? All right. Paralyzed and prone. I'll put the orders in. Right?
Yeah. Just
he's kind of very, oh, yeah. So, and you hear it and like, okay. And then you know that there's a couple of next steps you can take with paralyzed and prone.
Yeah.
So we're just kind of, do they always go together? What does each one entail? Right. Why do we do each one? It's kind of the things we're touching on today.
Yeah, that's going to be really exciting. But to start out, we just want to say, I think this is our 17th podcast that we have recorded.
Is it?
I think it's our 17th, maybe 18th. We'll have to check. But we want to say that we have reached over 6,500 people, more specifically plays on our podcast. And we're just like beyond excited about that.
5,000 of those plays are me. I play it on repeat at night to jack our numbers.
Okay, yeah. So we've been able to reach a few people. And then it also, the app we're using gives us an estimated audience of over 200 people. And that's really cool. We thought it was just going to be, people that we know, but we definitely don't know more than 200 people.
I know. We only have four parents.
Exactly.
So that's what I was confused about. I was like, yeah.
When our audience was four, it was like, okay, yep, mom, dad, and your mom and dad. Oh, yeah, that's exactly. Yeah. But we're just really excited, and we're happy that you guys are tuning in, and we hope you guys continue to like this. We're just going to throw this out. If you want, if you feel inclined to, if you want, you can leave a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts, and that really helps us out. Far, we have 16 5-star reviews, and that kind of blew us away. And I was going to read one really quick. It says, "Love your podcast. Been waiting for a new episode and loved listening to the RSI one. Bag them up. Super informative podcast for critical care nurses. Thank you, and keep them coming."
Cool. Now that's from NurseCast MC, and we actually don't know who that is.
No idea.
But we just want to say thank you for the review. We really, really appreciate it. So we're gonna keep them coming.
Keep them coming. So we're gonna be starting off with the prone and paralyzing. And so we're gonna start off with kind of why and when will we prone. We know that in ARDS, we will be, because there's such a difficult time being able to oxygenate these patients and stuff. But really, why, or what are we running into that is making us have to say, is there anything else that we can do to oxygenate this patient any better? Ben, is there anything you can think of?
You're doing things, obviously, as their requirements, their oxygen requirements go up, we're already doing stuff. We're either repositioning, we are doing, depending on what the problem is, if they are fluid overloaded, we're giving them diuretics. If they are having a different issue, maybe they weren't having a respiratory issue now they are. Mm-hmm. And now they're going that direction. We start hopefully treating the other issue.
Right. Absolutely.
Turning up their vent settings. Hey, they're not tolerating this setting. We're going to turn their vent settings up, whether we're giving them more FiO2 or more PEEP or whatever. So going – definitely treating whatever else is going on in addition to – attempting to fix the problem they have.
So you think of like a septic patient, we know that there's a profound widespread inflammatory response, and that makes its way to the lungs. That's one of the main causes of ARDS, which we're going to talk about eventually. You think of even other stuff like an acute pancreatitis or random stuff like that, that puts them in this spot, and we need to start treating, hey, what's causing this? We're talking about like the antibiotics or if it's they have a pneumothorax, we'll put a chest tube in, hopefully be able to get that. But when we've done all of these things, we've maxed out, or getting close to maxing out our FiO2. We're on 15 of PEEP.
Right. And so we're already in that respiratory failure. Now, yes, maybe we also have a different issue, but we are having an acute respiratory failure, an acute respiratory process. Now, the respiratory may even be our primary issue.
This is our big problem. Honestly, think of airway, breathing, circulation. they can't breathe right now. They can't get the oxygen they need. And obviously, once you have oxygen, eventually, you know, your body's going to go into this profound metabolic acidosis, and eventually, your heart will just stop beating.
Exactly.
And so, it's a very important, you know, process that's going on here.
Totally.
So that's kind of just touching the surface there of when we're going to be thinking about proning. We've really
exhausted our
resources.
Yep.
Yeah.
So now, this is basically just the next step. We've turned this up. We've done this. We've done medication. We've done some. They'll do medications for the lungs or whatever. But all that's done. Yep. Now, what is our next step? We're going to paralyze them prone.
Right. Paralyze them prone.
And do those always go together, Andrew?
You know what? Generally, I feel like when we're first starting out and we know we're going to be proning them, almost always we're going to paralyze and prone them.
Cool.
I was just going to say, with COVID, you know, we've been seeing this quite a bit. Almost every patient, even when we're only on 60 to 80% FiO2, but already on high PEEP, intensivist comes in, we're gonna prone them now. We know we're going that way. Let's just try to get ahead of the game a little bit.
Cool.
Right? Yeah. And so almost always those will go in conjunction with each other.
Cool. I agree. We did a little bit of research on this, and we found some competing evidence saying that sometimes, well, paralyzing doesn't always work or it doesn't always improve outcomes. Mm-hmm. I'm gonna pull from the Duke book though again here, and they're basically saying paralyzing or blocking agents should be considered in patients who are intubated for the following indications: to reduce the risk of villi caused by ventilatory dyssynchrony, to treat refractory hypoxemia, or to correct profound acid-base derangement. So if your patients are in ARDS and having those three things also going on, paralyzing them will help.
Right. So you said villi?
Villi, yeah. V-I-L-I.
Oh, okay.
Vili?
You want to tell them what that is?
Villi? Go ahead.
Ventilator-induced lung injury.
Nice.
Yeah, so paralyzing them so that they're not going to be fighting against that high PEEP, those, you know, even in our low tidal volumes and all that, we're going to be hopefully preventing some trauma to their lungs.
Because it is. There's a lot of pressure in there, and any sort of dyssynchrony with the ventilator, you can cause, volume trauma, villi.
Volume trauma.
All kinds of
borrow trauma.
Nice. Borrow trauma. So, yeah, no, totally. And in those three instances plus the ARDS, they're saying, yes, paralyze. I mean, I don't know how many respiratory ARDS patients I've seen that don't have one of those three.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I feel like they always have one of those three. So maybe keeping in their mind, you know, some practitioners may not use them together. They probably have research backing that, saying like, they don't go hand in hand necessarily. But now you know both sides of the argument.
Right.
And especially initially, when you prone, usually you're going to be paralyzing them.
Right. And something that we've seen even just at our hospital and what our intensivists want to do is it will paralyze for approximately 48 hours.
Nice.
Then after that, if the paralytic we see, we'll wean it down. Are we still able to ventilate fine? Are we having that asynchrony? Are we having that, you know, hypoxemia still? Oh, we're not. Okay, well, let's wean the paralytic off because that's not how our patient's supposed to be. We don't want them to be paralyzed all the time.
Exactly.
And so it'll just be that kind of 48-hour window when they're in that acute phase of really having some issues.
And then I actually seen that a couple of times too where, hey, the patient's not really getting any better. It's they stopped the paralytic. It's like, hey, it didn't work. It didn't help. That wasn't this dyssynchrony wasn't the issue. Let's just turn the paralytic off and see how we can do.
Absolutely. So. Cool. So those are kind of the two talks we're gonna be talking about. The one thing that we're just gonna go in and dive into is the why on prone positioning. Why does that increase PaO2? This is a very interesting concept, and it really all comes down to anatomy.
Yep.
Right? It all comes down to anatomy. So I want you to just, in your mind, we're just going to look at the chest cavity here, okay? We know we have two lungs. We have a left and a right. And that left one, in the front part, you know, our heart is tucked into there as well. So with that part, you know, that area, it's good at oxygen exchange, but it's not as good as the dorsal part of your lungs because there's no longer that area that's being taken up by the heart. So put in your mind, you know, we have this patient that's severely respiratory compromised and we throw them in a bed for 3 days straight. They're lying flat. Sure, we turn them every once in a while. But as, you know, they're so sick and they're in an ARD situation where they have an increased, pulmonary capillary permeability, their lungs are really filling up with fluid. And now they're laying down on that back part. And that part is where there's the most surface area available for oxygen exchange. And now it's just all full of fluid.
Nice. Right?
Alveolar collapse, there's not going to have that exchange. However, the front part of their lungs is not as much fluid there because it's all kind of flooded into the back, right? But now it's only a smaller surface area that is participating in an oxygen exchange because that heart is in the way, right? Nice. Yep. This is the less amount of space. So then what do? You flip them over. That fluid starts to push to the front of the lungs, and now all of a sudden you have that increased surface area of those dorsal parts of the lungs, and that's why you'll see an increase in PO2 from 40, 60, up to like 220, 240. Right, you're like, yeah. Man, what? You know, 30 minutes later on a gas, and it's like, man, so quickly, huh? How does that work?
You'll see their sat go up when you flip them. Flip them, their sat will be 91. You flip them, and it's like, they're satting 100. Yeah. You're like, holy moly.
Super interesting.
So cool. And I'm going to see if I can say this in a super simple way. Just a clearer fashion. I thought Andrew said that perfectly. I'm going to try to say it even a clearer version, almost for somebody like me who has to like re-listen to this stuff 5 times to get it. Basically, there's a good area of your body that ventilates well, and there's a bad area, and the heart sits in the good area. So if you put the heart and you move it over into the bad area, it's already a bad area. It wasn't really helping much anyway, so it doesn't decrease anything. But now that the heart is out of the good area, you have extra space in the good area.
Yes, because you're talking about when someone's in the supine position,
right.
The heart's in the good area. Right. But then we're in the prone positioning.
Exactly.
It's in the bad area, which doesn't really matter.
It was a bad area anyways.
Exactly.
Yeah. So if I have 10 feet of good area and I'm losing 3 feet to the heart, right? And then I have another 10 feet of bad area. Well, if I move the heart over to the bad area, I still have 10 feet of bad area. It's just taking up bad area and doesn't really matter. But now instead of having 7 feet of good area, now I have 10 full feet because the heart's not in the way.
Absolutely.
Just taking advantage. Super cool. So, like you said, it's anatomy, but it's just so cool.
Yeah. And you think like, oh, well, you know, if you're in that prone positioning forever, won't you run into the same issue? Like, yeah, eventually that's why we're going to be flipping them back.
Exactly.
But it's just the increased surface area that you have in that dorsal part of the lungs, because where the heart's not at, versus the front part. This is a very interesting concept.
Super,
and that's why we'll have
cool.
an increase in, you know, in our PaO2 and our sats almost immediately.
Yeah.
Very, very cool. Additionally, as we were going to mention, with that prone positioning, we have an increased recruitment of collapsed dorsal lung, alveoli, right? So we're recruiting those. And then also that redistribution of edema to the ventral regions.
Nice.
So in that dorsal part, the good 10 feet is all ready for oxygen exchange, right? And then also we'll have an increase in diaphragm motion. And then we're also going to have elimination of the compressive effects of the heart on that left lower lobe, as we've been mentioning.
Okay, so I am going to pause for a second and just the thing that Andrew literally blew my mind with, and he thought of this. We looked at the picture. I was like looking over something else, and he like, bro, check this out. Andrew, tell them.
Dude, so we think about someone that is in a severely compromised spot where they cannot oxygenate. What do they do? First thing the COPD patient does, right?
They tripod.
So yeah, like standing
forward.
Up.
Yeah, he leans
you
forward.
Lean forward.
No, tell me about that. Your second analogy.
What was the second?
When you're jogging.
Oh yeah,
jogging. You run a marathon.
Especially Ben and I, we're running. Not used to that.
No, then, very out of shape.
Yeah, so then we get to that point where you're like, oh, right, hit mile two. You know, you're keeping a good pace. And what do? You get down on your hands on your knees. And you're like, wow, oh man, I got to catch my breath here.
How do you catch your breath? You don't stand up straight. You bend over.
You bend over
prone,
on your knees.
You self-prone yourself. Yeah. Oh my goodness.
Yeah.
That was the sound of my head exploding when Andrew told me.
Yeah, sound of someone's lung exploding from his peep.
Yeah, from too much peep. No, you literally self-prone when you're trying. You just know your body naturally knows I need to lean forward. Oh, that's so much easier.
I catch my breath.
What do? You lean over.
Yep. So, the tripoding patient, you know, it's a safety survival mechanism
totally
built into us, right?
Love it. Yeah. Love it. So, okay, well, prone. Okay, so it's just awesome. You do this to the patients, you flip them over, their sat goes up. You start patting yourself on your own dorsal region, aka your back, because you are so pleased. Okay, you are the man, you did it.
But at what
did you
cost?
Do anything? Yeah. But at what cost? what did we do that kind of maybe, you know, obviously there's all, to every reaction, there is a concurrent reaction of equal whatever. You know, what is that from? It's Count of Monte Cristo. Bouncing the rocks against, you know. But what are we doing that's maybe hurting something else?
Speed of hand.
Speed of mind. Yeah. What are we doing that's potentially hurting the patient?
Dude, honestly, Okay, just backing up just a minute. When you prone yourself, like in bed, if you're just like, hey, I'm going to sleep on my belly tonight, you're fine. You know, you put your head to the side, you're chilling, it's okay. Because then if you need to go to the bathroom, you end up pooping your pants, you can get up and go, right?
Totally.
Or you can move your head to the other side. You know, it's just like, you know, naturally that way. All of a sudden when you're paralyzed and you're sedated, you have a breathing tube out of your face. You have a, you know, NG tube out of your nose. You have leads on you and you're in like the worst shape of your life. That's a bad position to be in.
Totally.
It's just, you know, more difficult to provide good quality care. And honestly, just thinking like one of the first things is that facial edema.
Yeah.
When someone's laying in that positioning, how quickly the breakdown can develop.
Exactly. It's all the fluid that's in your lungs. It all moves to the ventral region. Right. Well, the same thing happens everywhere in your body.
Right.
All that fluid shifts to the front.
Right.
And then on top of that, that fluid combined with the pressure, you can have all kinds of pressure issues on the face and all that, you know, it's just massive breakdown.
Yep, absolutely. And then like even just the devices that we're using to hold the E-tube in place, our ET tube in place, there's, you know, potential for dislodgement. I mean, you're flipping, say, I mean, you know, 150-pound patient. Oh, this is easy, you know. But you talk to any of these people that have worked on the COVID unit, talk about the 300-500-pound people that they have proned and the difficulty that it goes in with line management, airway management at that point. It's scary.
It is.
Like you have the RT with their hands like buried in there holding that tube in place while we're flipping them, hoping we don't rip out their HD line, their A line, and all that stuff. You know what
I mean? Totally.
Yeah, it's a compromising situation.
There's a couple of different ways that you can prone somebody and have a good outcome. I think that whatever version you want to use, whatever way you want to do it is fine. I think the biggest thing that we saw from the research is just practice and practicing it with your unit. So whatever your unit, you know, we do like ACLS protocols and training, and we do mock codes, and we go to these classes for Prisma, and we go this and that and the other. But like having your educator schedule a day of like, okay, we're just going to practice proning. And everybody has we practice our codes. Who's a recorder? Who's this? Who's that? You do the same thing with the prone. Who's at the head? Who's doing the shoulders? Who's got the feet? Who's holding the art line? Who's doing this? Who's doing that? And practicing that, you'll have really smooth ones. And remember mid COVID, it got smooth, man. It was instinctive. We get everything
going down the line, patient by patient.
Over and over, and exactly. And then we did one the other day, and there was definitely like a little bit slower with more provider dyssynchrony.
Right.
And so just it's like a skill with anything else. You practice it, you develop a rhythm, you know exactly what to look for. So just practicing it and being aware of everything that can go wrong, and it'll make for really smooth pronings.
Right, absolutely. Man, we should have talked about this months ago, today. Would have been great. So we're just also going to mention one of the things with all those complications. In one of the articles that we were reading, it said in the PROCEVA trial, which is, you know, one that is also often cited for prone positioning, there was no difference, in quoting this, in the rate of most complications between the supine and prone groups, suggesting that it is safe procedure in the hands of experienced clinicians.
Okay. Nice.
So we're saying that even with these complications or what's happening, that there was no difference. Not saying in outcomes that like, you know, oh, these people never got prone, but we're saying even when we're proning someone, those complications are within, you know, it's a safe margin that, you know, it's an okay practice to.
Right. And to initiate. Exactly. And, you know, okay, so it's harder to provide oral care. It's harder to watch their face for skin breakdown. It's harder to bathe the front side of your patient and this kind of stuff, but it's not impossible.
Right.
And in the hands of experienced clinicians, there was not a massive discrepancy between the two groups. And so knowing that and knowing that the patient needs to be prone, you just make yourself aware of these extra things you need to watch out for, and you deal with them while simultaneously saving your patient's life because you proned them.
Absolutely.
You know? So
cool. Those are all super great. Now, Ben, we're just going to mention one more thing when it comes to proning, and honestly, it has to do with sedation. Dude, in the order sets, when someone is prone, they're saying that the titratable range for prop, for example, normally is, you know, 5, 10 to 50. They're saying don't drop it below 20 if you can handle it. You know,
sure.
We want to keep them snookered. You know, the fentanyl, Versed drips. When they're in that prone, paralyzing positioning, very uncomfortable, very scary. You know, if you were to be awake during that time, you have a tube coming out of your throat.
Terrifying.
All that stuff.
Terrifying. I think it's very, very appropriate from what we've read to keep your patients very, very sedated, very uncomfortable, or very, very comfortable very comfortable for these pronings, especially if they're paralyzed. We have equipment that we use to monitor this.
Right.
We use the Train of Four. which TOF, train of four, it checks how paralyzed they are. And then we also use the biz monitor to see how sedated they are. Just a quick touch on that for the paralytics and the train of four. We pulling this from a book that we read quite often. It's the train of four. It's basically, it's that little zapper thing, right? And we just, you put it, you can put it at their thumb or you can put it at their eyebrow and a per unit policy, whatever you guys usually do. But this, I'm just going to read this sentence. This says the four twitches of the TOF disappear in reverse order as the degree of blockade deepens. This is called fade. So fade, it just as it fades away, you'll see it once you're used to it. It's very cool. But this is saying that with one, okay, so one in reverse order with the fourth disappears. So if the four, so you have three of four twitches. Okay, I've got three of four twitches on, you know, one of your paralytic. Okay, three of four twitches, that fourth disappears when 75 to 80% of receptors are occupied. So they are 80% paralyzed with one twitch gone.
Right.
You know, so you come in like, wow, this person, I got three of four. Like they need to paralyze them more? Probably not.
Yeah, they might actually be adequately paralyzed.
They're probably adequately paralyzed. And this said for surgery, you only need two of four. Two of four will adequately paralyze your patient for a full surgery. So if they're two of four, they're at 85 to 90% occupied. They are extremely paralyzed.
Dude, that's great. And I think using that tool is a great, you know, very specific, you know, repeatable test that we can do to see how paralyzed someone is. If you see like, oh, we're at three or four, do I need to go up on my paralytic? Because I don't want them moving at all. Why are they paralyzed? Well, let's look at the vent. Are they having asynchrony? Are we having difficulty there? We're not. Let's keep them at the three or four. Let's keep 85% of them, you know, saturated with the paralytic.
85%. What is he can? Well, cool. He can move his pinky, so I better like turn this up. No. And this even said, research has shown that most patients end up overparalyzed.
Right.
So just keeping that in your mind, hey, I have three or four. I'm probably good. My vent is good. This is good. The patient is, I haven't seen him move in 6 hours. He's probably adequately paralyzed.
My vent hasn't peeped once.
Yeah, I mean, if you have to go up, that's okay. But I mean, you should, if you were on four of four at five and now you check it and you're at 0-4, you probably should come off your paralytic. They're probably
very overly paralyzed.
Over paralyzed. Yeah. So that's train of four.
Right.
That's a tool we use, and that's a tool you use when you're proning people. So just there's your reference for that of how that works.
And very cool, we'll wrap up with biz monitoring per unit policy for you guys. I think ours is generally from 40 to 60. And it's basically a continuous EEG that's showing how sedated your patient is, because when you're sedating someone and paralyzing them, you want to make sure they're adequately sedated so you're not just paralyzing them and not providing any, you know, sedation.
Good. It's just a little strip that goes on their forehead. It's a BIZ. You know, what's the biz? It's just the biz monitor. It tells sedation. Do you know how the biz monitor works? Do you know what it's
just
reading?
Besides that, it's like basically I think it's a dumbed down EEG, you know, or basically, you know, I can't even pretend to know.
Do you know?
No.
Neither do I, because nobody knows. So biz has not released the science on it. So it is a little bit controversial at times. As far as how it works and what exactly it's measuring, because they won't release how it works, but it is an accepted practice. And I will also say, so just for your own sake, if you hear people talking bad about it, I will say we discussed it with a clinician who uses it all the time, every day, all day. And he said, I use it as an adjunct to my other objective data. So if I'm looking at their vital signs, then I'm looking at my vent, and then I'm looking at the biz, I'm looking at my train of four, and I'm all adding it together for a giant picture. He would never look at just the biz.
Mm.
Patient's hypertensive, tachycardic, moving around, but he looks at the biz and like, my biz is 30, I'm good. Right. It's not just one thing. You're going to plug it into your equation, and it's just an adjunct to everything else you already know. So that's the biz, and that's the train of four. Those are the two tools we use in conjunction with proning a patient.
So. Very, very interesting. Cool. Yeah, so that really kind of wraps up, I mean, a very, you know, scratching the surface knowledge of prone positioning, why it works. Remember, it's all related to anatomy, and then why paralyzing helps as well, and why it's sometimes used in conjunction together.
Yeah, that's kind of the again, there's so much that each one of these things that we could go into. We're kind of just trying to give you guys the major things you need to know, the meat and taters.
The meat and potato, the nuts and bolts.
The nuts and bolts. So this is just the main things. Now, the big picture, someone asks you, well, why are we, now you'll know. This is why we talked about the AMP.
Right.
We talked about the improved oxygenation. We talked a little bit about complications. And then you also know about those extra tools you're going to use. You got the train of four and you got the biz. So,
right. I think that really wraps it up. I think the only other thing we were going to mention was being okay with a spontaneous or a sedation vacation once we put them back into the supine positioning when they're on those very high, you know, sedation numbers, being okay to bring it down, watching how they're working with the vent, you know, and being, you know, willing to do that.
Totally.
And something that we were talking about is that some people are like, well, and
this
super
is this is unparalyzed.
So unparalyzed, absolutely. So yeah.
They're not paralyzed. We've come off the paralytic. Now they're supine. And I've seen nurses like take this opportunity to really quickly give them a bath,
right?
Which is awesome. I think it's totally appropriate. You have this chance where they're supining for a second, facial edema. We're going to take this chance to give them a bath.
Dude, yeah, but the other thing that you can do, well, while, you know, bringing down that sedation, giving them an opportunity to kind of wake up, because, I mean, you're on 50 of prop, 10 of Versed, 150 of fentanyl, whatever, they're totally out, and we're just not meant to be at that state. Now, I understand, you know, if they're still severely compromised, you're not going to be, you know, wanting to, you know, wake them up and have, you know, go for a walk down the hallway ventilated, right? But just being aware of that opportunity to bring those sedation levels down. And we were both collective on this, that oftentimes what we have seen is that people are very afraid to cut back the sedation. Like, oh, I'm only coming down by five or ten.
That's cruel.
Of
I'm not going to be cruel to my patient.
Yeah, I know, they have a
patient.
Breathing tube in. Yeah.
They're going to be cruel. What, you know what's really cruel? Not giving your patient the chance to live.
Right.
Like,
absolutely.
That's cruel.
Yep.
And
absolutely.
So, I think.
Or not being able to do a valid, like, neuro assessment on them.
Totally.
You know?
You don't even know where they're at.
Yeah.
So they're not on the paralytic. They're supine. A lot of times they'll grab a gas within 30 minutes of supining, 30 to an hour. But an hour later, they're still supine. They're tolerating it. We're not going to have to re-emergently flip them. You really quickly do a bath and you'd come down on the sedation a little bit and just give them a chance to live, man.
Right.
Give them that
yeah.
chance to live. You're not being cruel. You're giving them a chance to live.
And the other thing that we have to remember as nurses is that we have, you know, bolusing orders. We have the ability to titrate.
What's the onset of propofol?
Seconds, man. Like 5 to 10 seconds.
It's literally 15 to 30 seconds. Like, I can't, like, I don't want to come off the sedation. I won't be able to get them down. You can get them down in 15 seconds with propofol.
Right. You need to reach
15
yeah.
seconds.
Absolutely.
I mean,
yes.
You give them the vacation. It didn't work. Knock them back out.
Right. Absolutely. But you need to give them that chance.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, anyways.
Off of a little soapbox there.
We climb back down. But so hit us up with any questions on the email. We actually did have an email the other day. We were corresponding with a gentleman. If he gives us permission, we'll definitely talk about that because he did have a really cool question. We check it all the time. Don't hesitate to hit us up.
Yeah. Or hit us up on the Instagram.
Oh, we got
Gmail,
the gram. We got the gram.
Yeah.
We're hip. We're hip. So we have dad bods, but we're hip. So hit us up on the email and looking forward to hearing from you.
Yeah, so. Absolutely. All right, see you guys in the next one. Two Male Nurses expressly disclaims any liability in association with this podcast.